Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week, with Health and Pike River Reentry Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the human remains discovered at the Pike River mine and parliamentary security arrangements after recent anti-vax threats. But I started by talking about the traffic light system, which New Zealand will soon move into less than 2 weeks from now. I started by asking Andrew Little if that means the government now believes the country could not reach 90% fully vaccinated by then.
No, the opposite. I think it's because where we're at the moment, and it is totally achievable to get to 90%, Cabinet thought it was appropriate that we do give some certainty to people about when changes might happen. So Cabinet will make the final decision on the 29th of November. Prime Minister has already foreshadowed that we will remove the hard boundary around Auckland from the 15th of December. That still gives us a few more weeks, last few weeks, to get the vaccination levels up. We know that the number of first doses is now 90%, fraction over 90%, 92% I think for Auckland. We know that we'll get those second doses up for those who've got first doses. We know that there are some people continuing still to get first doses. So we will have a good vaccination level. It does mean that we can start bringing some certainty now to when we introduce changes, reduce restrictions, and get people moving again.
But are the DHBs at some parts of the country prepared for moving into the traffic light system, considering there has been reports recently coming out from the Lakes District that there is only, what, 4 ICU beds for 116,000 people?
Yeah, I was interested in those reports. They were somewhat misleading. Hospitals like Rotorua Hospital and Taupo Hospital have a limited amount of ICU capacity, but then typically a lot of their intensive care patients go to Waikato Hospital. The way we are managing the hospital response to the kind of further outbreak of COVID around the rest of the country is that hospitals will organise themselves on a regional basis. And so if people need hospital-level care and their local small hospital doesn't have capacity, they'll be moved somewhere where they can get that care. I should point out, too, I know people focus on the ICU beds. We now have over 4,000 active cases, 4,000 people who have COVID right now. That number has increased, probably doubled in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And yet the number of people occupying ICU beds has remained pretty much the same. I think we're at roughly about 7 at the moment. We were as high as, I think, 11 when the number of active cases was much lower. So what we're seeing, and this is because increasingly the people who are being infected with COVID now are people who have had either a first or both doses, and they are just not getting as sick as people who are completely unvaccinated. So on that basis, we have some confidence that the hospital system will cope with the demand that will be placed on it, and that combined with the care in the community approach that we're taking too, where more people will be able to recover at home and with the benefit of medications and things, we're confident that the system will cope.
Right, so currently there are 4,000 active cases. Is there a maximum number to when the hospital system will be definitely overwhelmed?
Well, I mean, if you look at current, so the total number of cases in hospital at the moment are about 88, I think, is the last number I saw. So it gives you an idea of the number of sort of hospitalisations per 1,000. So in order to get, we can surge our ICU level care, so it won't be all in ICU wards, but the level of care that is required, we can surge that to a maximum of about 550. To get to that number, given the proportion of people who wind up in ICU, you'd need something like 200,000 cases. Well, we don't have that, and we're unlikely to have that many cases at any one time, but the way we've managed it so far and the approach that we will take. So, I'm confident, and it will take effort, and if the hospital numbers rise, it does displace patients who are there for other reasons, but I'm confident that the system will cope.
Okay, and on to the traffic light system itself. Well, Auckland will definitely be moving to red if the Cabinet signs it off on November 29, but what factors will Cabinet take into account when deciding whether to move from, let's say, red to amber? Does that include hospitalisation?
Yeah, it'll include the number of cases we've got and the speed of infection more recently, and then the ability of the local health system to cope. And bearing in mind, as I say, that the hospitals will be organised on a regional basis, so it'll be groups of hospitals and their capability and capacity. So we'll look at all those sorts of things as we make decisions about moving up and down the traffic light system.
Okay, just a little quick touch on releasing Māori unvaccinated data to the Final Order Commissioning Agency. So how much of that data has been released?
Well, as I understand it, some has been released in relation to the Waikato region. There is some about to be released, subject to, I think, some further discussions or agreement for Tamaki Makaurau or Auckland. So that is in train. It has been slow, and I'm yet to have an explanation about why it has taken so long. And I certainly understand the frustration of the Final Order Commissioning Agency. I think we all agree that, look, this is an emergency situation. The High Court describes it as that in the case that the Final Order Commissioning Agency took to that court. And it is important, as now, if we're going to increase those vaccination levels, particularly for Māori, where the vaccination levels are lagging, we need to support Māori organisations with everything we possibly can so they can get out there and contact those people and get them their vaccination. So, look, the Ministry is, because they've got to make the decisions, it's their data, I don't get to instruct them what to do. They've had to do what they're doing, but I accept that the Commissioning Agency has been extraordinarily frustrated by the approach that has been taken.
Should this have been rolled out to the entire country, Minister?
Well, I think a lot of data has been released to a lot of Kapapa Māori Health Services and other iwi organisations doing health care and supporting their community. So, and particularly with Māori Health Services who have enrolled patients, all that data has been released to those practices. The issue here largely centres on unenrolled patients because they're not, because the, you know, the, no practice has an entitlement to that. But this is, you know, we've got to get these vaccination levels up, especially for Māori. So I think the High Court even said, look, there is an exemption in the Privacy Act that what would otherwise be a breach of privacy can be justified in certain circumstances, such as a pandemic emergency like this. So there is an expectation that the data, relevant data, appropriate data, will be released so that the commissioning agency can get on and with the job of lifting those vaccination rates.
Moving on to my second question of today, it's about the body remains that were discovered at Pike River yesterday. Kind of know, what are your first thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's just a slight correction. No bodies have been recovered. There's been images taken of what the police are describing as highly probably human remains. I don't know the full kind of detail of that, except that is what the police have judged it to be. That's as a consequence of a scanner that they placed down, a scanner that takes images down a borehole that they have been drilling. They've had a program of drilling a small number of boreholes to ascertain a number of features or aspects of the disaster. So yeah, so I got the news yesterday morning. It took me by surprise. I'm pleased that there is, you know, that the police have found something that gives assurance to the families that that, you know, the police investigation is thorough and ongoing and achieving something for them. And I think that's been useful. I think the difficulty is where the images were taken were literally in the farthest reaches of the mine. So probably another 600 metres to a kilometre away from the end of the drift, which is the area we got up to in the recovery operation. But would have had to go through right through all the mine workings, and we just don't know what state they're in. So the families will have various mixed emotions about it, but it does confirm just the thoroughness of the police investigation, and we need it to be that because we need the police to have every chance they can to consider whether or not a prosecution is appropriate.
Would this change anything in the criminal investigation?
Well, it gives the police some evidence. It's for them to weigh up what that evidence or what the significance of it is. But it means that they have firm information about where at least some of the miners, the underground workers were, and where they've ended up at, before they've lost their lives. So that'll assist them as they consider whether or not they can hold anybody to account for what happened.
Okay, I'm going to my final topic for today. Now, recently the Speaker said MPs can request more security for them, considering what happened last Tuesday, the Parliament, the protest in front of Parliament, and some abuse that your Labour MP, Kieran McInerney, has faced. What do you think of that?
Yeah, look, it's there are times when there are very, sort of controversial issues being dealt with by politicians at any time, and some people's idea of participating in public debate is to get a little bit unwieldy and out of control. I mean, there is no place for death threats and for threats of violence at all, but some people think that it's an appropriate thing to do with politicians, and some politicians think very carefully and then have to think about their security and the security of their families. So MPs have options about security for their homes and houses and what have you. I think what is being considered is whether or not some of that can be stepped up just a little bit more, so that MPs and their families can be just have that little extra comfort at a time when there are some reasonably volatile people around who at the very least are threatening violence, even if their ability to carry it out might be questionable.
Do you think it is more dangerous to be, well, let's say an MP compared to before the pandemic?
Well, we've had times in our history where political discourse has been, very heightened, and violence has been part of the imagery kind of used. And so, we have these periods. Personally, getting around, I haven't received direct threats to me physically. I don't get to see all of the correspondence that comes into my office, and I know that in the past I have had threats passed my way, but all those threats are assessed, and we rely on the parliamentary security and the police and so on to do their job, and they do a very good job. But I just think it's indicative of the fact that there's a number of controversial things going on, not the least of which is the way we're managing the response to COVID-19. But I just think, regardless of the frustrations people are feeling, it is right to have a debate. It's right to protest and to express the need for these cherished freedoms that we all have. But there is no place for violent and physical threats to people.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.